8 p.m. This is Radio Ghana.
Good evening to you, and you're welcome to Behind the News, our news and current affairs program, which examines issues from the perspective of newsmakers and experts. My name is Agatha Samoa, and tonight, Ohoi in the Volta region erupts as indigenous and Muslims clash. State loses yet another case, this time the infamous Amina Yutun bus mass rape saga. The question is, what is happening at the Attorney General's office? And as Ghana joins the international community to mark the World Day Against Child Labour tomorrow, what practical actions have state actors taken to deal with child labour? Our text line for tonight is 0266 677 7570. You can send in your comments and your suggestions. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana Accra and on all our regional FM stations across the country. Our text line again for tonight is 0266 677 7570. Now to our first story. There seems to be no end in sight to the inter-ethnic warfare that is currently sweeping through the country. Only last week, violence erupted in the central region, specifically at Ekunsi Nakwa, where Fantis and others exchanged gunfire over the death of an Ebusha Peyin in the community. But when everyone thought these ethnic clashes were coming to an end, another erupted in Hohoi in the Volta region today between the indigenous and the Muslim community. The reason the Muslims were infuriated over exhumation of the body of their chief imam from the Hohoi public cemetery, allegedly by the landowners. The Muslims quickly mobilized and engaged in fighting with the indigenous. The latest is that two people are reported dead, with several others injured. Government has meanwhile imposed a dusk to dawn curfew on the area, besides a massive police and military presence. Let's get first-hand information on the early morning skirmishes from an eyewitness, Eric Okoto, who was close to the action. You are welcome, Eric.
Yeah, good evening.
Good evening. So can you tell us, how did this whole incident start? What did you see?
Well, the incident started in the morning. But before then, it was last week when one of the Muslim guys was electrocuted. So he was sent to the Hohoi Hospital. And then, unfortunately, there was a little bit delay to the at the emergency service. So they were demanding for his ID card and then some other things, which were not available. So suddenly, the guy passed away. So he was then sent to the cemetery to bury it. And the hospital said they wanted to take an autopsy to know what was happening or what happened before the guy died. And then the Muslim community said, no, they are not ready for that. So they want their body to go and then bury. But the hospital insisted to take that, and then they said no. So later, some of the guys rushed the guy to the mortuary, and then they beat the mortuary man. They sent him to the cemetery to get buried. So the traditional area got angry that the case has to be investigated before the body is being buried, but they refused. So due to that, yesterday their chief imam died, and then they went and report the case that they wanted to go and bury the chief imam. And then they told that the Sue and then the chief palace, they said no, they will not allow them to bury before because of the previous incident. So they should hold on. So the police came into the scene, and then they were escorted to the cemetery to bury the guy, the chief. So what happened this morning was, they realized that the body was exhumed to the Hohoi Kasikan road. So the Muslim community got angry, and then they started the riot. So they went to the chief palace to burn his cars, and then they would break down his doors and stuff like that. So the whole town was in the mess. So, but the security agency did very well. The police and then the soldiers were in town, and then the whole thing, they are trying to ensure that there is peace.
Eric, from your accounts, can you tell us who attacked who first?
Sorry?
Can you tell us, are you able to tell us who attacked who first?
Well, it was the Muslim that started the whole thing. because of their chief imam being excluded from the cemetery. That was what got them angry. And then they started attacking the Arabs. They started by burning lorry tiles on the road and then went to the chief palace to destroy certain things there, like the cars got burned and a whole lot.
Did you hear any gunshots and see some of the injured?
Yes, there was a gunshot from the Arabs to the Muslim, and then one of the guys got dead. And then later in the day, the soldiers were trying to separate these two people, but the Arabs wouldn't listen. So they were throwing stones against the soldiers, and then they also thought their life was at risk. So they shot them, and then two guys got dead.
Eric, haven't the Muslims been burying their dead at this particular cemetery?
Yeah, that is where they bury their people at any time they have situations like that.
Then one will ask, why was this body exhumed?
That is the question. So we didn't know what is happening now, because they got very angry because of the chief imam being taken out from the cemetery again. That is why they got very angry.
So can you tell us the situation now, if the place is calm and there are police parading the streets?
Yes, the situation is calm at this moment, and then curfew has been declared from 6 to 6. So now we have a lot of policemen and then the soldiers. The security are really doing their work. They, I really appreciate them for that. The security is very keen at this moment. So the whole town is quiet, everybody is in his house, and then we are only hoping to see what will happen tomorrow morning. But for now, the situation is calm.
All right. We are very grateful for your time. Eric Okoto is an eyewitness to the incidents in Hoho in the Volta region today. Now, joining us on the line is the Volta Regional Minister, Henry Ford Kamel. You are welcome, sir.
Thank you, my sister.
So, did you actually see this day coming, or you never had any hint of it?
It's quite a difficult answer to answer. Yesterday, our attention was drawn to this problem in Hawaii, where the chief imam had passed away and was supposed to have been buried at a Hawaii cemetery. But the chiefs and people of Hawaii didn't want to grant permission for the burial, because there was an outstanding feud, apparently, between the chiefs and people of Hawaii and the Muslim community. Apparently, the mortuary man to the Hawaii hospital had been assaulted, and the mortuary man is an indigent. And so the matter came to the attention of the Hawaii chief. And so they had some discussion with the Muslim leaders of the Muslim community for the perpetrator of this crime to be identified and brought to the chief's palace for some kind of interrogation. This didn't go through. And so when the chief imam died and the permission was being sought for the burial, the chief and elders refused to grant permission for the burial. I talked to the chief yesterday, and he said they were not happy that the Muslim community was not respecting their authority as landowners. And so that is how this whole thing started. So we got wind of the situation. But at a certain point, we had the understanding that things had calmed down and permission had been given for the burial of the chief imam. And so we all went to sleep until we woke up this morning to the news that the body of the chief imam had been exhumed, and to the annoyance of the Muslim community, and that's part of some violent confrontation between the Muslim community and the people of Hawaii.
Yeah, you talked about a feud between them. Have there been any attempts to solve it?
Honestly, our attention was drawn to this feud yesterday when I tried to find out from the chief why they were restraining the Muslim community from burying their imam. And they said, look, this is the situation, and there has been a consistent behavior from the Muslim community, and that behavior sought to undermine the authority of the landowners, the traditional authority from Hawaii. And so that was the only time when my attention was drawn to a kind of feud between the chiefs and people of Hawaii and the Muslim community. But we thought that the problem had been solved because I instructed the ISEC and the municipal chief executive to go into some negotiation with the chiefs and people of Hawaii. And the understanding was that they had agreed that the body should be buried. And so we all thought that the matter had been settled until we woke up and realized that there was another dimension to the problem.
We understand there was a meeting this afternoon. What was the outcome of it?
Yeah, RECSEC met. I also went personally to Hawaii to have an independent assessment of the situation. I was in the company of the police commander in the 66th Artillery Commander. And after an assessment of the situation, we realized that they have to request for a curfew in Hawaii because the intelligence information we were receiving indicated that supporters of both factions were massing up and there was a possible attack, maybe somewhere in the night. And so we thought that for the military and the police to have full control of the situation in Hawaii, there was a need to apply for a curfew. So we applied to the Minister for Interior and he gracefully assented to our request based on the recommendations that we made to him.
And how long is the curfew going to last?
For now, it's for a period of about just 4 days. And then we'll review the situation when the period expires. And when we realize that there's still a need for an extension, we will apply for an extension. If we realize that it's no more necessary, we will take it from there. But right now, the situation is calm. I'm happy to report the situation is calm. The security forces have taken full control. People are beginning to realize that RECSEC and government is in control of the situation. People are beginning to realize that they must respect law and order. People are beginning to have confidence in the structures that are in place to resolve the issue. And so we are happy to report that for now, there's calm.
Early on, it was a chieftaincy issue at Kpasa. Yesterday, it was Hou, and now Hohoi. You seem to be confronted with security issues. How are you handling it?
It's not so much of a chieftaincy issue. Yes, the Kpasa one borders on chieftaincy. In Hohoi, it borders on authority. It borders on authority and the extent to which indigenous authority should operate and function. It's not who should become a chief in Hawaii. That is not the issue. The issue is that the indigenous feel that their authority as landowners has not been respected. But for now, our priority is to establish law and order. We will come to this issue when we have consolidated our authority on establishing security in the area. We will come to the peripherals, we'll come to the assistance, and then we'll try to see how we can get along with some of these issues. But for now, our priority is to establish law and order.
And how has RECSEC been able to deal with the whole riot?
I've just been telling you what RECSEC has been doing, my sister. RECSEC is in full control. First of all, we realize that we'll have to beef up the security presence in Hawaii, and so a detachment of police and military personnel have come up to beef up the presence of local security personnel there. And I'm happy to report that this has greatly helped calm the situation. You have large numbers of the soldiers, you have large numbers of the police everywhere in Hawaii. They have visibly seen, they have positioned themselves strategically, they have established their control, they have announced their presence, and people respect their presence, and people are beginning to respect their authority. Then we have also come up with the issue of this curfew, which is also an appropriate response to the situation in which we find ourselves, and we believe that it will help to mitigate whatever negative reactions we may be getting. So RECSEC, I believe, has responded appropriately. We continue to monitor the situation and as and when it becomes necessary, we'll get appropriate reaction.
All right, so we are very grateful for your time. That was the Volta Regional Minister, Henry Ford Kamel. And let's also tap the expertise of Paul Abraham Pamensa, Program Officer of the CDD, who has also joined us on the telephone. We are grateful for your time, sir.
You're welcome, my sister.
So should we read meanings into all these ethnic clashes?
Well, it's not everything that you've spoken about this evening that borders on ethnic or tribal clash. I mean, there are some of them, as the Honorable Regional Minister said, that border on authority. And there are a whole lot of issues that have come up since 2009. And then even before that, various reports, even the lead up to the 2008 elections, indicated as the police administration marked out almost about 100 districts or constituencies that were tagged as conflict-prone. Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center and the CDD Ghana in our conflict monitoring also were able to mark out about 60 constituencies that was tagged as conflict-prone constituencies. When you look into the criteria used in tagging constituencies or districts, some of these issues were in it. Chieftaincy clash, lingered conflicts between tribes from different places, especially people who have migrated, call them internal migration, migrated from one region to the other, and also people who are fleeing from conflict areas. So these things have been there, and they are sometimes, I like the words that people use, yeah, being increased. And the question is, ask ourselves, why this time? That's the problem that we have to get ourselves for in the lead up to the 2012 elections.
So what can be done to prevent such clashes?
Well, the first thing that we say, when you look into the Constitution, and even the nature of human beings, people, there are problems everywhere. That is why we have in place institutions. That's why everybody, people who have read conflict and the theories of conflict, talk about strong institutions and application of the rules. When you look into the issues that have cropped up in the elections and after the two elections, people seeing bungalows, people sacking DCs, people killing, even at the murder of three people at WC, you don't see any action, serious action that have been taken. In cases like that, people think it is free because there are no stringent or punishment for people who engage themselves into conflicts. I did say something that in the era of elections, that people point to authority. People point to people who have been accredited to serve one way or the other at a certain position, that we do not want this person here. And the person who has the authority to do perform certain function is sacked or moved away from that area. It's flouts the law. What is criminal must be treated as criminal. So what we can do is to strictly enforce the law. Find culprits, punish them, let them bring them to book so that people will know there are institutions and laws are being enforced. I heard my Honorable Minister saying the situation has been beefed up. We have a police presence, we have a military presence. Go back to Boko, go back to Yendi, and ask how many police and military people are there, yet we see over and over again a conflict of weapons. That is not the solution. The solution is putting our agencies, intelligence agencies to work, the BNIs, the national security, the police CIDs, to the ground to work. Bring out the leaders. Bring out the people who perpetrated the conflict. Let us punish them. If you start applying the rules rigorously, I think it will serve as a deterrent for people to perpetrate the crimes.
The emerging conflicts that we are talking about, are they threats to our democracy?
Seriously, my sister, when it goes into the theories of conflict, there are stages. But the worst of it is that there is no, in our current system, there's a guy that says that when two people are fighting, don't ask what is the problem, ask what happened yesterday. Elections are seen as an opportune time to avenge wrong done people, institutions, individuals, or a group of people. So they present an avenue, and because of the kind of politics we practice in the country, people are emboldened, other perceived or real, that I have a backing of a certain group of people, a certain class of people, and therefore I'm free to do that. Let me give you an example of what happened at Chibodom. That one chief was captured, detained, manhandled, because it is perceived that my government has come, so I can do what I like. It might be a perception. The government itself might not back that action. But because people have been, the politicians have been preaching such words, people think, yes, we have the authority to do that. So it has a very, very serious implication in our elections. And anytime such things start happening, we have in our conflict monitoring report, you realize that in the olden days, electoral activities, public activities, were directly related to the increase of violence or conflict. But in this time, from 2009 up to 2010, we recorded more incidents of conflict, even when the Electoral Commission had not officially rolled out any public activity. So now entering into the official activity calendar of the Electoral Commission and other political parties, we have to be very careful.
Do you think state institutions like the security agencies have not lived up to expectation?
My sister, when I always make this example, there was this this guy who was killed. One policeman called Ninja some years ago. Within 48 hours, the policemen were not there, but the body where it was buried, they were able to see it. Recently, a certain chief was killed in Accra here. When the police cracked, within 48 hours, they were able to make arrest. Why is that when it comes to certain specific aspects of conflict or individuals, we don't find conflict? Sometimes we compromise ourselves, our situation. We think when we do certain arrests, it's going to spark another conflict. But it is the absence of enforcement of regulations that brings the recurrence of conflict. But I think, yes, in certain circumstances, in some aspects, the security agencies are not doing well.
Briefly, what is the way forward?
The way forward is strict enforcement of regulation. Let us be proactive. Let us apply the rules. It is because of human behavior that we set up institutions. It is because of human behavior that we have rules and regulations. So let's apply the rules and regulations to regulate our society.
We are very grateful for your time. Paul Abraham Pamensa is the program officer of the CDD. Is behind the news live on Radio Ghana Accra and on all our regional FM stations across the country. And these are some of your text messages. Frederick Gape Treponi in the north says, whenever there is conflict, which in some cases leads to war in some countries, it is our wives, caring mothers and lovely sisters who suffer the consequences. These clashes threaten the stability of the country. We are waiting for the Central Regional Minister to again tell us that Hohoi issue was caused by the pronouncements of Kennedy Ejapong from the political speaker Wen Chizongo. From CAD Nicholas Chenchenku, Ghanaians must well be educated on child labor to help eradicate it globally. The good people of Hohoi and the Zongo community should try and smoke the peace pipe. Without peace, we can't develop as a nation. It's only one Ghana we have. That's from Aziz Donlawa. Whoever instructed the exhumation of the body of the chief imam should be blamed for the unrest in the area. And that's from Issa. From Akoto Razak, conflicts retards the development of Ghana. Ghana is the only country we have. From Tanka Alavano, why always Zongo use condolences to the bereaved families? Indeed, the people of Hohoi should know that no one will live forever. That's from AU Farouk Tamale. And we need peace in Ghana. Why are there ethnic clashes in the country? May God lay his almighty hand on Ghana. God save us from Greece. Wow. It's behind the news live on Radio Ghana, Accra. Today lost another case brought against Amina Mohammed in the controversial Yutongba's mass rape and armed robbery incident. The Accra High Court threw out the case because the prosecution failed to adduce any evidence to support the charge of causing fear and panic leveled against the Amina Mohammed. The latest ruling brings to 15 the number of cases that the state has lost since 2009. some of the high-profile cases that the government has lost, include the Ghana Atuti case brought against former Chief of Staff Kwejom Pieni and Dr. Charles Reku Brobe, the case against former Foreign Affairs Minister Akwesi Osei-Eji, the release of 15 people charged for the murder of Yana, the Jacobitibi Lamte Bangalo saga, the Kennedy Ejapon case, among others. So why does the government continue to lose such high-profile cases? But before we delve into why the government continue to lose cases, let's talk to Andy Apiakubi, a member of the defense team for Amina Mohammed. You are welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
You must be very happy with today's proceedings.
I guess every one of us is happy about proceedings because this is victory for the law and victory for human rights.
So what other reasons did the judge give for throwing out the case in court?
Well, there is an obligation on the prosecution to provide evidence substantial enough to be able to seek conviction or substantial enough to be able to expect the accused person to open his or her defense. But in the case of Amina, the judge was convinced upon invitation by counsel on the submission of no case application that the state had not provided enough evidence to warrant an order on the accused person to open their defense, and therefore the submission of no case was upheld.
With today's ruling, what does it mean for the rule of law?
Well, in today's ruling, we have extended the law to that area of freedom of speech where speech alone, without malice and without any intention to cause any such fear and panic, and without causing the panic and fear, should not bring liability to any such accused person in communication to a group of people or to the state.
We are very grateful for your time. Andy Apiakubi is a member of the defense team for Amina Mohammed. And we are also joined on the line by former Attorney General Ayikwe Otu. You are welcome, sir.
Thank you.
You have been a former Attorney General. What processes do you go through before prosecuting the case?
Well, as we know, under the Constitution, Article 88, all prosecutions are done in the name of the Attorney General. But also remember that officers of the Attorney General Department prosecute cases more in the Superior Court, which is High Court. So most of cases in the lower courts are handled rather by trained police prosecutors who themselves are not lawyers. We may have difficulties sometimes with police prosecutors. It does not mean that they ought not do it, because as you are no doubt aware, the lawyers in the Attorney General's department are not that many, and they cannot be seen to be prosecuting everywhere. That is why by law, the Attorney General is authorized by an executive instrument to appoint other prosecutors to assist in prosecutions. So it is presumed that or assume that some of the cases that go to the lower courts, like the district and circuit courts, are not that weighty. And that when you are police prosecutors, they can also assist in the pushing the hearing of some of these cases. Now, it therefore must be clear in the minds of the public that when a case is lost, it does not follow that it was the AG's representatives who actually prosecuted the case. I don't know about that. I mean, I did not follow it, and I cannot say whether it was the prosecution that did it, or rather the police personnel. But generally, what the position is that it is the prosecution, the police investigators who would conduct investigations into any matter Once they need the advice of the Attorney General, will then forward the docket to the Attorney General for advice. When the Attorney General representatives study the file and find that there is some merit, they may ask them to proceed with the prosecution. If they find that there are difficulties, they may then bring their professional expertise to bear on the trial. Sometimes they even take it over and they handle it themselves. So if the, for example, you can then have two scenarios here. We can have a scenario where the police prosecute, they do the investigation and prosecute. And then you have a scenario where the police would do the investigation, hand over the docket to the Attorney General for advice. The Attorney General will give an advice before they go and prosecute. In all these cases, if the maybe the prosecution is not handled properly, and in the lower courts where policemen prosecute, because they are not lawyers, they are not authorized to do what we call an address. They cannot address the court. So you may find a smart lawyer on the other side who has the right to address, but the prosecution has no right to reply because they are policemen who are not trained. And then they may, you know, succeed. It may be getting or convincing or the judge to throw out the case. This may be some of the difficulties that they have.
With the way the government continues to lose cases, will you say the state prosecutors do not do enough investigation before prosecuting the case?
That is rather the point I'm making. Is the prosecution is never done. Sorry, the investigations are not conducted by the Attorney General's Department or officers at the Attorney. It is rather the police that do or undertake the prosecution, so, the investigation. So, like, when they finish, it is for them to refer the matter to the Attorney General's office for advice. Then we will study the, they will now study the evidence or record so far. And they can say that, please, don't prosecute because you don't have sufficient evidence. You are likely to lose the case. But sometimes they do their own investigations and proceed to do the prosecution as well. But you have that situation where you are not a lawyer, you cannot address court. At the end of the day, you get some of these police lawyers bamboozling you and getting you on the wrong foot. I am not saying by that token that, therefore, if the Attorney General themselves handle a matter, they should win. No. Again, it will depend upon the nature of the evidence. Please, let us also remember that when you allow yourself to be pushed to do a political trial, you are also likely to lose the case.
So if you are to advise the current AG, what will you tell him?
My advice to him is that it should be professional as much as possible. It should ensure that cases that go to court are going to court on the merits, that you are likely to win and have a successful prosecution, than that you are being compelled to charge somebody with genocide and treason because he has just opened his mouth to say something. You see, if you do these sort of things, you continue to lose. The Attorney General should not be engaged in political trials. He should ensure that he goes to court because he has evidence. If there's no evidence to support the prosecution, please do not do it at all. Otherwise, these are some of the things we'll be saying all over the place.
Now, briefly, how will you feel if you are the current AG and the government continues to lose cases?
Oh, it is very disheartening because the buck stops with you. The prosecution is at your instance. That is why I made this point that Attorney General is such a very, very heavy, responsible job that you go and sit there to ensure that things are done properly. You cannot leave it with others to do it for you. If you do that, they may even sabotage you. You have a responsibility to ensure that, for example, if you see the thing is a high-profile case, then sit down with your lieutenants and ensure that what you are going to do will bring some benefit before you move. Otherwise, to keep on losing, you have difficulty on your hands.
All right. We are very grateful for your time. That was a former Attorney General, Ayikwe Otu. And also joining us on the line is Lawyer Abraham Amaliba, who is a public interest lawyer. You're welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, and good evening to your listeners.
Good evening. So what do you make of the acquittal and discharge of Amina?
This is a court decision, and I respect the decision of the court. I do not think we need to labor the point. If the state is minded, the state can go on an appeal. But as it is now, it is a judgment of the court, which is a court of competent jurisdiction, and I do not intend to falter that judgment.
With regard to the number of cases government is losing, do you think government is not doing enough to prosecute those cases?
Let me indicate that cases that the state has lost is not peculiar to only this regime. Indeed, we all know the popular case of the state versus Tachikata, where Akufo-Addo, then Attorney General, lost that case, but there was an appeal, and the state had to reverse the decision, the judges have to reverse the decision. But at least we all know that at the court of first instance, the state lost it, and Akufo-Addo was the one prosecuted. Every attorney general has lost one case or the other. It's just that our memories will not be able to serve us. But it is not peculiar to this government. That's the point I want to say. Now, it is important to indicate, and I agree largely to some of the submissions made by my senior equal to that, a lawyer is as good as his brief. And so if your evidence is not sufficient, and when I say sufficient, I mean if you don't have credible evidence and you go to court, you'll definitely lose. And with the system that we have now, where you have investigations being conducted by the police whilst some prosecutions are done by the Attorney General, I think that the lack of coordination where the Attorney General is not part of the gathering of investigation is what is sometimes making things difficult for the Attorney General to win cases. Again, the conditions of service at the Attorney General's Department also contributes to some of this lackadaisical attitude being exhibited by the Attorney General officials. Sometimes the cases are adjourned because the Attorney General official has not appeared in court. When you find out, you know that it is an attitudinal problem, just as any public officer who doesn't go to office. When you go to the ministries, you know that some people are either working lotto or are doing some other things. That's the same thing because it's a public office. And so people are saying that, look, because the remuneration is not so good, it does not attract good and qualified lawyers to the Attorney General's Department. But let me quickly add, I'm not saying that those who are there are not good. But because the remuneration is not good, their attitude towards the work is also something to talk about. And so these are some of the things that may lead to some of the things that we are seeing.
Will you then recommend review of the way prosecution is done in the country?
Exactly so. My recommendation has always been that if we do not have enough lawyers and we want police to prosecute, and I agree with the former Attorney General Ikwetu, who says that the police are not lawyers, so they lack the competence. If we think that we don't have enough lawyers, and so we want the police to assist in prosecution, what we need to do is to allow the Attorney General, to take part in gathering the evidence so that there can be that synergy between the police and the Attorney General. Because as it is now, sometimes no investigation has been done at all by the police. You have armchair investigations. They sit in their office. They cook up some story. I'm not just trying to impugn their integrity, but sometimes it does happen. They hand it over to the Attorney General. He goes to court. He loses. They say the Attorney General has lost. So I think that we need to have some synergy. Let the Attorney General be part of the investigation gathering. And then from there, he knows what is of evidential value. He knows what is not of evidential value. And then when it comes to prosecution, he can now take over. But if he's sitting in his office, then police is also in their office. Something. Then they will just bring some file to him. That is not enough. And I think that the way we go about prosecuting is one thing that we should review.
All right. We are very grateful for your time. Lawyer Abraham Amaliba is a public interest lawyer. It's still behind the news live on Radio Ghana Accra and on all our regional FM stations. across the country. And these are some of your text messages. Raymond Akati from Petoy says, Muslims in Hohoi should know that no matter how a frog is big, it can never prevent a zebra from drinking in a river. Ziblim Adams Gusho says, the NDC government is dragging Ghana into darkness. Is President Mills actually aware of the pockets of violence going on in the country? We need him to talk now. The conflicts are getting too much. That's from Dixon Desire Laura. The self-confessed murderer of the family head of a Kunfinakwa should be mentally examined. That's from Kwabnada for Takwade. The constant losing of cases by state presupposes that there may be a problem at the AG's office. It is a wake-up call for the government to act quickly. Ajayn Kuma Imus Sefiyoso. Herbert Adubule says the Muslim community should know that they are under the chief of Hohoi and must obey his orders. And the people of Hohoi have no business assuming the corpse. It is highly inhuman. It is highly inhuman and should be widely condemned. From Charles Jatong Kambau, and what happened between Muslims and the chief at Hohoi should not extend to other parts of the country. Please add your name when you are sending the text messages. Now to child labor. Do you know that it is against the laws of Ghana to engage a child in hawking sachet water by the roadside? And are you also aware it is illegal to employ a minor below 15 years as a household? These are some of the common practices that occur in most Ghanaian communities, even though they are abuses of the rights of their child. The International Labour Organization says there are hundreds of millions of girls and boys throughout the world who are engaged in work that deprives them of adequate education, health, leisure and basic freedoms. It is in this direction that the ILO has dedicated 12 June as World Day Against Child Labour to highlight the plight of these children. Ghana will join the international community to mark the day tomorrow on the theme, Human Rights and Social Justice, Let's End Child Labour. What is child labour and to what extent has Ghana been able to prevent child labour? Tonight, Behind the News, we'll be discussing this and other related issues with some stakeholders. Mrs. Elizabeth Akambombure is with the Child Labour Unit of the Ministry of Employment and Social Welfare. You're welcome, madam.
Thank you.
For the purposes of education, who is a child?
A child is any person below the age of 18. This is by our the Children's Act.
Now that we know who is a child, what then is child labor?
Child labor is any work done by any person below the age of 18, which is injurious to the person's health, deprives the person of his education, and also hampers the group, the general group of the person.
You talk about various forms of child labor, the worst forms of it, and hazardous child labor. What are these?
Yeah, when we say something is hazardous, we mean there are hazards associated to it. And when a child is engaged in any work that is hazardous, the child could be hurt by the work. And for instance, if it is fishing, if a child should go on the sea, the adult and the child think differently. And the child could drown if the child has to disentangle himself under the water.
And the worst form of it?
The worst form of it is when it is unconditional, when it is hazardous, and the child would be deprived from education, and it can also harm the health.
So let's get some education here. If someone engages a child who is below 15 years and is selling ice water after school hours, what is it?
Yes, a child selling ice water after school hours. It may be child labor or not. If you have a store, if a parent has a store by the house, stays there and sells various items, and maybe with an ice chest in front, and maybe after close of school, the child is only to sit there for some few minutes for the parents to maybe do something in the kitchen or in the house and come back and take over. It is not child labor, because the child will go back to the house and will be able to do the homework and have enough rest before the following day. But if the child has to take the pure water and run after cars after school, it's still classified as child labor, because running after cars has its own hazard.
Then under what conditions can one employ the services of a boy or child as a house help?
Under the Children's Act and even the ILO Convention 138, at age 15, a child can be legally employed, and it is at age 15 because we assume that by age 15, the person should have completed the basic school. And if for one week or the other, the child is not able to continue, the child can work. But the child works at supervision. And that's work that is not hazardous and will not harm the child. Under those conditions, a child can work under supervision.
So how then is light work defined in our statute books?
Night work.
Light work.
Light work, okay. Yes. Light work. When we say light work, we mean any work that the child can combine with schooling and will still have enough time to do homework and rest before the following day. Light work is any work that a child does or somebody below the age of 18 does that does not prevent the child from going to school and does not bring any harm on the child. Such as house chores. The child comes home, the child will wash dishes, can help the parents in preparing food, will have enough time to study, and then rest, go back to school the following day, refresh. We don't call this child labor, that is light work.
So a child helping...
A child can even help the parents on the farm, and it's still light work, in that if it is over the weekend or after school, the child works for some period of time. So child work and child light work depends on the age. You take into consideration the age, the type of work, and the duration before you can classify it as child labor or not.
How about a child helping the mother sell kenke at night?
A child helping the parents sell kenke at night may also be defined as child labor because it depends on the time that the child stays to work with the mother. After 8 p.m., the child is not supposed to be working. The hours of 8 p.m. and 6 a.m., a child should not work. If a child works between those times, it is night work, which is prohibited for the child.
All right, just hold the line for us as we are joined on the line by the Executive Director of an NGO Network for Community Planning and Development, NECPAD, Paul Asamoah. You are welcome, Mr. Asamoah.
Thank you.
So what is NECPAD doing so far as child labor issues are concerned?
Well, NECPAD is an NGO, so we're doing direct implementation. We're working with the ILO in a number of districts in implementing programs to eliminate child labor in mining. Specifically, we're working in Gasa district. Well, we are working in mining and quarry. So we're talking about Gasa district, where we're implementing a project to eliminate child labor in quarry activities. Then we're also working in Sakwa and Swayim Municipal Assembly, MPC of New Valley District Assembly. And we're working in Wasamifi East, and then Palantir Nandam. We also work in the city district, and then we're working in Amantia West.
So how would you do
all these areas? Yes. In all these areas, we're targeting 2,227 children whom we are withdrawing from child labor in mining. Part of them would be direct withdrawal, and then we'll rehabilitate them, put some of them in school, and put some of them in apprenticeships. The others will be prevented, so we'll supply all the necessary input for them to be able to go to school and to learn apprenticeship.
So what would you say are the challenges you face in your crusade against child labor?
Well, mining itself, and particularly for gold mining, it tends to be very attractive. On many occasions, we have children who are put into mining as a result of attractiveness of the enterprise. For a situation where a child will go to carry a load or so and would get something between 5 to 15 Ghana cedis a day, and that alone is attractive. So they use some of these things to support household income. And so you realize that parents will even be pushing children into galamsey activities, for instance. And that alone is a very huge challenge to us, because you need parents, you need community, you need society to help you to implement some of the projects. So if you have a situation where society itself is pushing some of these children into mining or galamsey activities, then it's a huge challenge. But then we also face other challenges like resource constraints, because all along it has been ILO which has been supporting us to implement this project in all these districts. And we started in 2006 to 2008, and the second batch is from last year.
Would you say Ghana has been able to deal decisively with child labor?
Well, I think that Ghana is doing its part. In terms of mining, the challenges are huge because of the attractiveness of the enterprise. But I think that Ghana itself is doing a lot of work in supporting other NGOs in implementing various types of interventions in galamsey areas, galamsey district, and in other areas. So I think that ILO, the Ministry of Employment and Social Welfare, and other related organizations are doing a lot to help. But then we have a huge task, and we need to mobilize resources in order for us to implement big time some of these interventions to contribute to eliminating child labor.
All right, we are very grateful for your time. Paula Samoa is the Executive Director of the NGO Network for Community Planning and Development, NECPA. Now back to you, Madam Akankombere. So, to what extent has Ghana been able to deal with child labor issues?
Ghana has done a lot in dealing with child labor issues. In 2000, when Ghana signed a memorandum of understanding with ILO to eliminate child labor, Ghana has been able to, with the collaboration of its partners, social partners, and NGOs, have been able to withdraw a lot of them. ILO has supported government to implement a time-bound program that was in 2006 to 2009. Before then, several other interventions had already gone on in trafficking and other areas. And now, ILO is supporting or sponsoring the government to implement four other programs. That is the community, Cocoa Community Project, the Private Partnership Project, and then the ECOWAS 1 and ECOWAS 2. We have presently about four of them running at the same time. And these are all supported by ILO to run them. And they are supporting a national plan of action that the government has put in place to guide the implementation of all these programs to eliminate child labor.
So briefly, how is Ghana marking the day?
The day was planned by a subcommittee of the National Steering Committee, which came out with activities such as a media lunch. Was held on the 6th of this month, 6th of June, and then the Children's Day on the 7th of June, and we have media discussions all over the FM stations and the TV stations, especially this one that we are holding presently. And the main day is tomorrow, where all partners are coming together to have a national child labor forum. And the media is not left out. They will also be there with us tomorrow.
All right. We are very grateful for your time. This is Lisbeth Akambombere, is with the Child Labor Unit of the Ministry of Employment and Social Welfare. And also joining us on the line is Andy Tego, who is the head of programs at the General Agricultural Workers Union, TUC. You are welcome, Andy.
Thank you very much.
So this year we are looking at child labor being human rights and social justice issues. How do you explain these?
Yeah, of course. Thank you very much for this privilege. The child has a right. And the child has a right, according to our constitution, to food, to shelter. Also, the child has a right to education. And above all, he has the right to be a child. So this is the year that is dedicated specifically to look at the angle where the child can express his right freely. And then we also look at how the issue of rights can lead to the elimination of child labor in our country. So this is a very interesting year for us because we want to exhibit and involve the child in exhibiting its own rights.
What has been GAWI's contribution to fighting child labor on the labor front?
Yeah, thank you. GAWI, as a member of the main TUC body, had done significant things in the communities to ensure that child labor is removed and then the day is also well celebrated. In the communities where we are present, we have brought farmers together to celebrate the day. Also, in the areas where we have created child labor free zones, we have also brought child labor to bear in terms of the people in the communities celebrating. But more also at the trade union level, we have trained, we are, as part of the celebration, we are training all the district councils of labor. We want the tripartite. You know the tripartite, when we say tripartite in Ghana, we are thinking about minimum wage. We are thinking about things trade unions do. But we want to use the tripartite at the community level to begin to address the issue of development and then also bringing children out of labor. So district councils of labor in all the country, all the districts in Ghana have been trained on how to handle child labor issues as part of the trade union's contribution.
You know, Andy, yeah, Ghana was accused of engaging in child labor in the cocoa industry. Would you say we've been able to deal with the issue?
Yeah, knowing the problem is half the solution. So we have moved in the early 2001 to 2004 from the denial stage to the stage of accepting that we had elements of some of the work children do in cocoa production can be classified as child labor. And immediately that came up, you know that we don't consume the cocoa, we export the cocoa. And the consumers began to raise alarms because nobody wants to consume chocolate made up of child sweat or child blood. So they began to raise this. But thank God, the government of Ghana, the Ghana Trade Union, the Ghana Employer Association and other NGOs responded positively and quickly.
All right.
Immediately, government put in place a program called NEPLEC. ILO came out with a program in four cocoa communities, and this is addressing the problem in Ghana.
Action plan.
What action plan do you have? Hello?
Hello?
Andy? Yes.
Yeah?
Can you tell us? Hello?
Can I tell you?
One of your action plans.
Of our action plans for this year.
Yes.
Yeah, one of the main action plans for this year, especially in the cocoa communities, is to ensure that the district and community child protection committees work very well. It's to ensure that chiefs in the communities are also involved in the process, chiefs and pastors and the stakeholders. As we speak to you now in Asenkregua, the ILO is celebrating the day in a big way there. Also in the other parts of the Chifuhima Lower and other communities. What we are promoting is that Ghana has developed a response
and that's the National Plan of Action. And we're calling on all stakeholders to join in implementing the National Plan of Action.
We are grateful for your time. Andy Tego is the head of programs at the General Agriculture Workers Union, TUC, and these are some of your text messages. Elias Tamale says, violence here, violence there, violence everywhere. What has government done to avert these disturbances? Voltaires are noted for peace, not violence. Why these clashes? Please give peace a chance, from Atibu Moses Biwa. Makumba Atwa says, why are civil society groups quiet about the putout strike? Please speak up, as you did to UTAG. Politicians are the cause of all these crises, especially the all die we die slogan for Musa Gumda Sang. Government should consider 3 years and pay putout their money. Teresa Wah, SSM1 says, Ghana is a peace loving country, so we should safeguard it. We beg President Atta Mills to kindly look into the putout issue. We, the students, are really suffering, for God's sake. So far from Bute, NYEP teachers are dying. Please, it is an election time, so do us good. From Eric Bli Ningo Papram, Ghanaians should stop fighting and live in peace. We are one people. Abukari Idrisu Papaliga Zabusugu. And that's where we wrap up for tonight's edition of Behind the News. Bobby Nikwe controlled the sounds. My producers were Edmond Tete, Phyllis Kofi, Christopher Siedu, and Kingsley Obinchere. My summarizer was Barbara Yakubu. I am Agatha Asamoah, and thanks for listening.